Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Fine. I'm listening to my nominee for the Obama campaign song.
Oh, gosh. You know, if you would give me some advance notice, I could have a clever little bit of repartee there, but I have no idea what it is.
But check it out. It's really good.
Am I supposed to be hearing something?
Yeah, you're not hearing anything?
No.
Okay, well, anyway, it's called The News by Carbon.
Oh, so the Sounds of Silence, is that it?
No, it's called The News by Carbon Silicon. Anyway, it's the guy who was the guitarist for The Clash.
Wow.
And he has he's put out an album, and one of the songs is called The News, and it's sort of like a punk version of Happy Days Are Here Again.
And it's your nominee for Obama theme song, or other people are talking about this?
No, just me.
Okay, well, from your mouth to God's ears, or whatever.
Anyway,
and
sorry.
I'm sure that's the way it'll work. Thanks to your influential blog.
Perhaps our viewers could hear it, but probably not.
If I couldn't, there's a chance that they won't be able to. But anyway, I'm sure that the entire Obama campaign thanks you for this and many other favors you've extended it, like that recent blog item of yours where you said, "This is the most damaging story about Obama I've ever seen."
Well,
and linked to that to publicize that. That was nice of you.
Well, it was an interesting story. I have some vestigial journalistic instincts to actually find out the truth about the guy who's going to want to be going to be president of the United States, as opposed to mindlessly plump him at every turn.
Okay. Well. Tell me when you come up with a post that starts the most damaging story about McCain that I've ever seen. Okay. Then you will be.
I trash McCain much more than I trash Obama. It's just on immigration reform, and you don't approve of it, Bob.
Yeah, but that. Well, anyway.
Why doesn't that count? It hurts him.
I digress.
You
know, I went to see the movie WALL-E this weekend.
Congratulations.
That was really a little... I said that too soon. I was waiting for you to say, "So what have you been doing?" To inquire about my welfare. I would have said that.
Assumes that assumes I'm curious about
WALL-E.
Your welfare. I was exposed to the raw brutality of the Wright family last week.
Yeah, we talked about that on the last dialogue, in fact, and about the amazing jumping abilities of my dog, Frazier.
So anyway, but WALL-E.
Is WALL-E is a kind of fish or something,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. You haven't seen it, though?
Mm-mm.
Are you eating, Mickey?
I was drinking a cup of coffee.
Everyone should see it. You know, it's a morality tale about the eco-salvation of the planet, and it's kind of refreshing in light of the various apocalyptic headlines that we're seeing, which I will recount shortly. But it was actually really, really, really quite good. You should see it. It's not just for people with kids. And that's what everybody's saying about it, but it's true.
Isn't it a cheap anti-Bush diatribe?
Well, I wouldn't say anti-Bush per se. No, it's very... No, I didn't... Maybe I'm forgetting something, but I wouldn't even say it's left-wing, properly speaking, because, you know, what it is very ecologically minded, and it's a critique of consumer culture. It's also a critique, ironically, given the fact that it's a Pixar movie and Pixar's owned by Apple, it's a critique of the culture brought to us by computers, which is to say one of increasingly virtual experience, where, for example, you might have a conversation with somebody when they're not actually in the same room with you, you know?
I find that deeply unsatisfying.
It's very unsettling that this could happen. But anyway, it is a critique of consumerist culture. It's a critique of, you know, kind of lazy virtual interaction and recreation as opposed to kind of, you know, real life blood, sweat, and tears endeavors, such as saving the planet from the ecological apocalypse. But no, not Bush per se. And the reason I wouldn't say it's lefty per se is that ecology is increasingly embraced across the board by a number of people on the right, partly because they think, I think rightly, that there's a national security argument for weaning ourselves from oil.
You may be right. I still find a politics of ecology inherently boring in a way that the old politics of ideology, class warfare, liberalism, and conservatism is not boring.
boring just because you're not interested in it.
If our future is the fight to save the planet, I think I may retreat into my virtual reality. Thank you.
It's not my obsession either. The form of planetary salvation I'm more interested in is averting the so-called clash of civilizations. But
there you go.
I think it's important, and I think it's something, you know, we can rally around. It's something that, in principle, could bring a number of nations together. Movie. I mean, it's also... Well, go ahead, sorry.
Rallying is not the word I would use.
Why not?
Because it's an inherently insipid, uninteresting politics, that's why. I don't know quite why. I have to figure out why, but it is.
Yeah, you should figure that out. I kind of halfway know what you... it's funny, I have that same sense, too, that it's not super sexy. Well, it's very technocratic in terms of the solutions, you know. It's not like you don't get to go send whole armies and invade countries and stuff.
And it's sort of not about the society... It's not about the interesting question of what kind of human society we want. It's about the question of creating the conditions in which we can... debate what kind of human society we want. It's sort of a step backwards to a precursor question, as opposed to the interesting question, where once we have a planet we can live on, how do we want to live?
Well, no, but the questions are intertwined. I mean, as I said, this was a critique of a highly materialistic culture, and the critique was not only about the ecological consequences of that, and in any event, the critique certainly doesn't have to be. There is the question of lifestyle isn't only a question of material consequences. Right? There's a whole Buddhist critique of a consumerist culture that's not about the ecology of it.
Right. Well, that's a more interesting...
So, why are you saying it's...
That's a more interesting critique.
Okay. So we should do that kind of critique.
It seems to me that a lot of the, you know, this is a standard complaint, a lot of the ecological critique of consumerist culture is people who really want to make the Buddhist anti-materialist critique, but they're losing that one, so they bring in global warming and say, oh, well, this is why we can't have a consumerist culture.
Yeah, there may be a certain amount of convenience involved.
Anyway, people who are talking to each other on consumerist video cams via an internet that's become a consumerist vehicle... shouldn't complain all that much about consumerist culture.
No, we shouldn't. I mean, the joke in WALL-E is two people sitting on these Barca loungers, each holding a computer and interacting with each other via the computer, even though they're, like, right next to each other.
I did that just the other day.
Did you?
Yes.
Well, there you go. You may see yourself. You should go to this movie. You may be in it. Who knows? You know enough Hollywood people so that you could actually be a character in this movie.
I don't think so. My banter involves being viciously de-linked from Josh Marshall's Talking Points memo site.
I'm not sure what we just did qualifies as banter, but anyway, proceed with yours. What is it again?
Well, Josh Marshall used to list me as one of his approved sites, and I've mysteriously disappeared from that list.
Doesn't seem mysterious to me, Mickey.
I contacted him, and he didn't, it's not something he did, so it must be something
his underlings. In the vast Marshall Empire, who knows what level
this was
done at.
It must be something his bitter partisan cocooning underlings did.
Yeah, right. That's what I would have said, too. That was very clever.
But I forget, I'm positioning myself as the bigger man in this controversy. I still like Josh Marshall's side, even if they don't approve of me.
You know, it's interesting you should say that, because I think our commenters are a little bit wrong about why your claims to be a liberal seem so disingenuous, okay? And this gets back to my just now complaining that you're doing this Obama-bashing stuff. I think it's not just that you're actually a crypto-conservative, although that may be the case, but I think you have gotten locked into this symbiotic relationship with right-wing bloggers, where you're dependent on them for your links. If you remember, in the early days of your blog, you and Josh Marshall used to link back and forth a lot, right? Well, somehow that quit happening, And the greatest interdependence seems to be between you and Instapundit, to judge by the frequency with which he links to you, certainly.
There's a certain amount of truth to that. You become prisoner of the people who send you links. I claim... Well, first, I just posted something about how Joe Klein is surviving the anti-Semitic... The neocons playing the anti-Semitic card. I don't think that's something that Instapundit particularly would approve of. You try to ignore these things. But yes, you become dependent on people who link to you and send you links. So what? Everybody is.
But if you're blogging
here. On the other hand, Josh Marshall has the problem that he's dependent on advertising for people who are looking for a reliably partisan Democratic site and want to use it to shill for campaign funds. I submit that is a more serious conflict that he has to deal with.
Should I send Josh Marshall the Dingle Link with this devastating critique of him?
I think I've made it before. When he started getting money there's a New York Times magazine article that chronicled the day money started rolling in from blog ads. He became less of a neoliberal site and more of a partisan, Democratic fight site. He's a man of integrity, and he is still, I don't think he's changed his views, but I think the site's emphasis changed in ways that are consonant with what his advertisers wanted. He still says, he still says things like, I am a Zionist, and he writes a pretty moving, essay on why he's a Zionist. No, and no blogger did more to pave the way for the Iraq War than Josh Marshall, even though he was against it by the time we invaded, he had shifted against it. But he was, publicizing Kenneth Pollack's book and saying, yes, it does make sense and it's compelling, and it certainly helped pave the way in my mind for the Iraq War.
So, Mickey, this link to your site getting taken off of his site seems to have really taken a toll here. We're laying out a pretty broad gauge critique of Josh Marshall here.
I guess I'm not doing a very good job of...
What do you think about his connection to global warming, Mickey? Okay, we've covered the Iraq War. What else has he done?
I guess I'm not doing a very good job of sucking my way up.
Rising above it.
Sucking my
way
up.
Rise above, man. You're bigger than this. You're Mickey Kaus.
It's a great site. He had a good article about McCain just today. McCain said that the basic funding mechanism of Social Security was a disgrace.
A little late for that makeup call,
guess.
Mickey. But I'll tell you, I'm going to spend the rest of this dialogue trying to raise your serotonin level so that the next time somebody takes you off of their blog role, which is probably happening more frequently than you realize, you'll be able to rise above it. Okay?
Thank you. That's why we go to you for therapy, Bob.
A lot of people come to me for counseling, man. And there's a reason. Now, just to get you to slightly depressed before the long phase of serotonin raising, a lot of headlines about the apocalypse over the last 36 hours or so. Okay, so like, I think it was yesterday that a suicide truck bomb at the Indian embassy in Kabul took the largest toll of any. I think of any terrorist incident since the Afghanistan war in Afghanistan. Today, the U.S. Consulate in Turkey, some guys shot up the security guards there. Also today, Iran announced that it had test launched several missiles, including one that supposedly can reach Israel.
Well, only one of those is truly apocalyptic, Bob, the last one.
Hey, I'm not done, man.
Okay.
What was going to be the silver lining on the week's news, which was that oil prices dropped a little yesterday, sending the stock market up. Well, so much for that, because with the missile launch, oil prices went back up, stock market continued its long plunge. Now I'm done.
You're turning into Juan Cole seeing catastrophe around every corner.
Well, he does pretty good traffic. I could make a living off of that. But what's your reply to this?
Well, the only one that seems of lasting significance, unless you're going to react in horror to every bombing around the world, is the Iranian missile test, and I can't. What I can't tell is, are they trying to deter a confrontation with Israel or provoke a confrontation with Israel?
I think deter. I mean, the whole thing. I don't think they want to be bombed. It's actually a common human sentiment is to not want to be bombed. Although you can imagine how it could work out for them well politically in some gruesome long-term sense, but. No, I mean, you know, Israel had staged these exercises, these Air Force exercises that were correctly taken as a hint that they were thinking about bombing Iran. And one question is, what message were they trying to send? Was it just to Iran, or was it also to the larger community saying, come on, let's get serious with a negotiation and don't force our hand here? But the reason people worry about a fairly near-term Israeli strike is because the timetable isn't set by the Iranian nuclear program. If it were, there would be no reason, I think, to bomb within the next year. But it's set by the American political electoral timetable, right? Because Israel would want to do this not just before Obama might be president, but really before you have any new president. It's just an easier thing for a lame duck president with only a few months left to sign off on.
Well, you think? Right? Because it would be very controversial. Because there's of course a connection between that and the Iraq War. I mean, the Iraq War looks like it's going pretty well for us. The one thing that could really screw us up is if Israel attacks Iran and Iran retaliates in Iraq by upping the amount of sponsored terrorism. And Robert Kaplan makes that point in a pretty good Atlantic Post that we'll link to, and pointed out that that's why we're unlikely to give Israel the go-ahead, because Gates doesn't want to screw up the progress he's made in Iraq by having this retaliation.
There's another
that
point
sort
he
of
makes,
makes
which
sense
is
to me.
Kind of, but and there's one other point he made to that effect, which is that. The thing would have to have America's fingerprints all over it, because they would need to fly through Israel would need to fly through our airspace to do
well,
the bombing,
either
through the Gulf or over Iraq.
They'd sort of need our permission, yes.
Right. But I would say that with Kaplan, I mean, my interpretation of that post, where he winds up thinking that the strike isn't going to happen, is that's just him being pessimistic. He's a famous pessimist. I mean, you think I'm bad about anticipating the apocalypse.
He wants the strike to happen, and he's pessimistic?
I think Kaplan would definitely want it to happen, yeah.
Just because he worries that a nuclear weapon in Iran's hands would be trouble?
Lots of things about his past writing lead me to the conclusion. I mean, there's this weird sentence in his... Got his piece here somewhere. There was this very weird weird kind of sentence in it, where it's the following sentence: for even if a moderate Republican realist like John McCain, very weird characterization of John McCain, a moderate Republican realist like John McCain, or even worse, a liberal left internationalist like Barack Obama, is elected president, each is likely to subsume Israel to larger geopolitical considerations rather than hold it up as an icon to be both supported and worshipped in the post-9/11 era, as George W. Bush has done. That's a really weird sentence on a lot of grounds, but...
Well, if it's a pro-Israel sentence, he wouldn't have used the word worship. That's the problem. I thought he was mocking the Bush administration's attitude toward Israel in that sentence.
So the even worse is meant ironically?
That
may be the only explanation.
Where does
even worse is meant ironically?
Where does the even worse come in? I forget the...
For if a moderate Republican realist like John McCain, or even worse, a liberal left internationalist... Because I thought Kaplan was himself a realist. He's not a neocon. But to call McCain a realist of any kind seems to me bizarre. As we discussed earlier, he wants to, like, kick Russia out of the G8, classic non-realist kind of thing to do, and he seems totally to be singing neocon tune. So
yeah.
I don't know, but that. Sorry about that digression. Yeah. Maybe you're right about that whole sentence.
But anyway, Kaplan's article, he did convince me that your apocalyptic worries are a little bit overblown, and that we're probably unlikely to let Israel do the attack.
I don't know that Bush is unlikely to. I don't think he's hostage to Gates' views. I think Bush, given the way he still thinks of himself basically as divinely ordained to do something great, I think he's a wild card for the rest of his administration, personally.
Well, first, the Iraq success, such as it is, will reinforce that sense that they may hate him while he's president, but they'll love him in the history books. So why not do it again?
I think...
And go ahead.
Well, you could argue that both ways. I mean, I think a way that could play out in Bush's mind is, and in a way, this is Kaplan's argument, I guess, except without mentioning Gates, is that, you know, it's finally looking as if Bush's grade for Iraq, the grade that history will give him, is moving from an F minus to an F plus, as I would put it, or you might put it from a D to a C, but whatever. It's looking like his legacy won't be so bad. But, you know, if Israel bombs Iran and Iran wreaks havoc in Iraq, which I think they're capable of doing in reply, there goes that upgrade of his grade, right?
Right. I think you're grading too tough.
You always do when I'm grading Bush. But you see the point?
Well, yeah. But no. Yes. But it could go both ways. The can I give my this segues into my tripartite analysis or scheme of Iraq and how it affects the election? Because it seems to me that the Iraq thing is going well enough now. I.e., it's not a D, but it's approaching a B, maybe a B minus. Is, you know, we agree that like there are three possibilities in Iraq, two of which help Obama, one of which helps McCain. Everything's going to hell in a handbasket. It's hopeless. That helps Obama because let's get the hell out. Everything's
well, and just because he was clearly right about the war and McCain was clearly wrong, and that's more vivid if that's the case, right?
Well, but if you assume that elections are about the future, it's also if it's a lost cause, why stick around and have our people get killed?
I think when you're in the middle of a clearly catastrophic war, the election is partly about the past. If one candidate clearly favored
Either way, it helps Obama.
It helps Obama.
Let me get through this. And if it's really good, if everything's going swimmingly, it helps Obama because, hey, we can withdraw and everything will be fine. And it's only if it's in the middle, if it's like tentative, fragile success that would collapse into chaos and genocide if we leave, that McCain is helped. It seems to me the developments of the last few months are moving us from the middle category where it helps McCain to the it's so good it helps Obama category. In other words, we're now at the point where people are less worried about Obama withdrawing because they don't think he's going to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory and screw things up. And McCain's only argument is, hey, we should stick around to really capitalize on the success of the surge. And I don't think that he gets much traction with that argument.
Well, I think it's true that if things seem really stable in Iraq, then Obama's, his withdrawal plan looks pretty good. And that helps him. That part of it helps him. I think the other thing that helps him, I mean, the downside of that from his political point of view is that the war is not so obviously a disaster, even though I think it was a disaster regardless. But what I think is helping him politically is really two things. One is watching Afghanistan fall apart, which everyone seems to agree it's kind of doing, because almost everyone agrees that one reason things are so bad in Afghanistan is the diversion of resources and attention to Iraq for the war. So Obama can make that argument that Afghanistan would be, in much better shape. And not only that, but the instability from Afghanistan spreading to Pakistan, which, of course, has nuclear weapons, because a lot of the Taliban are now located in Afghanistan. So that's... in that sense, it's in sheerly political terms, you could argue that it's kind of the best of both worlds for Obama.
Well, that just reinforces sort of what I said. In his context, attacking Iran is one of the few things that could help McCain because it would screw up Iraq enough to put it back into this middle category of we don't know what the outcome is.
I kind of beg to differ. I think Iran also plays into Obama's hands analytically because if you ask... why would Israel attacking Iran be so problematic for the United States? A big reason is the consequences of the Iraq war. We are there and we are vulnerable to disruption from Iran in retaliation for an Israeli strike. So that's a talking point for Obama, I think. What's the scenario where you're imagining this helping?
I was just applying this analysis to the point of absurdity, whereas because it would make Iran, put Iran back into the category where if we pulled out, it would be a disaster. But you're right.
Yeah, you're right.
It would kill McCain. If
well, and also just try to just try to play out what would actually happen on the ground. I mean, you can well imagine if Iran retaliates big time in Iraq, as well as, you know, they claim that they're going to send missiles in the direction of American ships in the Persian Gulf. So in any event, you can imagine that actually starting a war between Iran and American forces over there. And I don't think many people are going to be enthusiastic about, just when Iraq seemed to be stabilizing, us suddenly being in twice the number of land wars we were in before over there.
Here's an interesting question. I always thought that taking Iraq off the table doesn't really hurt Obama because McCain has no other issue except Iraq. There's all this talk about let McCain be McCain, and Rich Lowry pointed out that letting McCain be McCain means he talks about Iraq constantly because that's what he wants to talk about. So I'd always thought that if you take Iraq away, Obama wins even bigger because on domestic issues the Democrats win. And I'm now beginning to wonder if that's true. If you really think about taxes and the Supreme Court, there are domestic issues on which a Republican candidate should be able to score points against Obama. I don't think McCain is that candidate. But I think on gas prices he may be able to.
But
in what?
Gas prices. You know, the drill here, drill now movement.
Man, that just so doesn't. Maybe it's because I'm one of these rich West Siders. I'm not rich, but I'm a bachelor, so I don't have a lot of expenses. Where I would gladly pay $2 or more a gallon, and have all the people who can't afford to pay $2 or more a gallon off the road, so I can get to where I want to go. Which is what's been happening the last month. Is that you, in LA, you can now get places for the first time, and so high gas prices are sort of my friend, and it's a horrible sort of truth, dirty little secret of the rich to admit this.
I think there are some swing voters who aren't looking at it like that. But
obviously polls show gas prices are really important, and everybody's trying to capitalize on gas prices. And it does not strike me as a promising strategy for McCain, because people know that drilling in Anwar and wherever we're going to drill isn't going to. A, it's not going to solve the long-term problem, and B, it's not going to solve the short-term problem. So, because it doesn't come online soon enough. So
no, and I mean, if I were Obama, I would kind of have be tempted to turn gas prices into a big national security issue. And although I'm not sure he can do this politically, but I mean, somebody might as well make the accurate point that look. The sooner we wean ourselves from oil, the better for the world. I mean, not just because, you know, Arab authoritarian states in particular, it's kind of, you know, the high oil prices empower them and in a way that's particularly bad for their further political evolution, right? Well, where am I? It gets complicated from there, because both McCain would claim that it's his goal too to wean us from oil. But the fact is, lowering—and this is the part that Obama probably wouldn't say—the fact is, lowering gas prices is not the way you wean us from oil.
But you said there was a larger issue than the fact that oil supports authoritarian Arab states.
Oh, sorry. I just meant that in a very abstract sense. Oil is bad for any state. It has a bad resource to be dependent on. But it does happen that most of the states we're talking about are Arabs. There's also Venezuela.
Yeah. The problem is, if you talk about it in national security terms, that the one logical response is, well, let's have energy independence, which is a really terrible idea.
It's a great slogan.
Independence is a terrible idea.
I think it's a good slogan. I think most of the things you do in the name of energy independence are things I I'd personally approve of.
It involves a lot of drilling off the coast and in Anwar and ripping up the
I don't mean that kind of thing.
Ripping
no,
up the
I mean,
Rocky Mountains.
I want to wean us from oil per se.
Yeah, well, weaning
and
us
you
from
don't
oil.
Do that by lowering gas prices by drilling for more oil.
Well, what's going to convince Americans to do that is that they can see all sorts of neato solar and electric cars that they can drive, and they want them. So that I mean, and that's happening. That's about to happen.
No, I mean, there's this car that has a range of 100 miles, and all you do is plug it in. And so, however your local electricity is being generated, whether it's, you know, coal or natural gas or whatever, that's what's being consumed.
Well, there are hundreds of cars like that, and one of them is going to catch on, so.
Yeah. I think enough about that.
What?
You started to segue
I had one more
McCain's
question, which is Maliki announced that he wants a timetable.
Yeah.
And who does that help? And I think that also helps Obama, doesn't it?
I think it does. McCain has already said he's fine with that Iraq is a sovereign country and they can tell us to get out whenever they want. But it certainly makes it harder to depict Obama's position with scare headlines, right? I mean, if Obama's position is, I want to be out, 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 no permanent bases. I'm not sure he's quite said it like that, but if the sovereign Iraqi government and democratically elected Iraqi government is saying the same thing, you know, he's betraying Iraq, right?
Yes, but I think it helps Obama just for the general issue that without Iraq to talk about, McCain has nothing to talk about, because it also makes you less worried about McCain, because the basic worry about McCain is he wants to stay in Iraq for 100 years. He's much more willing to tolerate a long-term commitment with troops being stationed there and dying than Obama is. And if the Iraqis are going to kick us out, well, you don't have to worry about that for McCain anymore. So that should help him. But actually, since Iraq is his big issue with Obama, his only hope was to somehow make the argument that Obama is failing to capitalize on the sacrifice of our troops and we really should stay there for 100 years. And if you take that away, you know, what does McCain have to run against Obama on? I don't know. So I come to the same conclusion.
Well, he has the surge. Him saying he got the surge right, Obama didn't.
That's right.
But I do think that Obama, an important part of Obama's rhetoric should be to make the connection between Iraq and Afghanistan on the one hand and Iran on the other, because those are going to be, you know, hot spots, and they're going to be hotter precisely because of the Iraq war. It's a valid point to make, and I think that's could work well for him.
Okay, well.
The other thing is, I mean, on the timetable issue, the Iraqis said, I mean, first of all, al-Maliki himself said the goal is to end the presence of foreign troops. Foreign troops, that kind of stings, you know. I mean, but you can tell the sentiment he's playing to. I mean, there's apparently a lot of public sentiment in Iraq that doesn't want us there.
That doesn't sting at all. William Safire, who always said that, you know, the war would end with the Iraqis kicking us out, and that's victory.
Okay.
And Instapundit, interestingly, in a post said, hey, if the Iraqis kick us out, if there's a stable government that's elected, that tells us, sovereign government, that tells us to leave, that's a win. That's not a loss.
No, I saw that item, and I think that is the way the Republicans should play it. And McCain, since that he posted that, I think has started playing it that way.
I think it's the truth. The interesting...
Well, you think the war was a good idea? It's a win?
I think if there's a stable Democratic government that kicks us out, I think then the war becomes a win that wasn't worth it in terms of the larger cost of blowback. But
so it wasn't worth it, but it was a win. You won, but on balance you lost.
Yes,
it's
called a Pyrrhic victory.
A Pyrrhic victory. Well, I think the definition of a Pyrrhic victory is an overall strategic loss. So yeah, I'd buy that.
Well, right, but the point is that. Well, anyway, you're once again. You're listening to your grad students and not to reality.
What do you mean?
It's a big deal if instead of leaving Iraq with our tail between our legs as it degenerates into chaos and genocide, we leave Iraq with a stable government that kicks us out. That's a huge improvement in the possible outcomes made possible by the surge that you refuse to acknowledge.
No, it's a big improvement over utter apocalypse. You're right.
Well,
it's better than complete, immediate apocalypse. You're right. Much better. Much better.
There's a very good Michael Crowley article in the New Republic analyzing Obama's shifting Iraq positions, pointing out, and the basic bottom line is, he's really creating a strategic ambiguity. We really don't know what he's going to do. He's being careful to tell the left he's going to get out, but he's left all this wiggle room to stay in. And his campaign just depends on maintaining that ambiguity until November and he becomes president, and then he has to decide. But we really don't know. There's a huge unknown factor. We do not know. We don't know what the situation on the ground will be, but we also don't know what he will do. We don't really know his instincts. There's all sorts of speculation by aides. Oh, he's really going to withdraw. Oh, and then we have Samantha Power saying, oh, he doesn't really mean it. It's interesting that on this basic question, he's as much of a pig in the poke as Nixon in Vietnam.
Well, I think increasingly people feel unsure about what exactly he's going to do in office. We talked about that a little last week because of his tacking to the center. I mean, only yesterday there was a pretty devastating column from Bob Herbert in the New York Times about this issue, about how much he's departed from his campaign rhetoric. I don't know. Again, I think the big difference, I mean, last week I said I think the big difference between him and McCain is we'll be out after, by the first term of an Obama administration, out from Iraq. Now that Iraq has just informed us that that's going to be the case, maybe, as you suggested, that's not such a difference between him and McCain. I don't know.
Well, there's a lot of, as Instapundit suggested, there's a lot of bargaining in the Iraqi strategy. I mean, that seems the way things go over there. There's a lot of posturing ahead of time. Maliki has to maintain his political support. And then in the end, everybody caves and they do a deal. And that's probably what will happen here. As Juan Cole pointed out, that what Maliki is asking for is completely unacceptable. He's asking for American troops to be prosecuted in sort of automatically in Iraqi courts and under control of the sovereign Iraqi government. And none of, according to Cole at least, none of our status of forces agreements with any other country provide for that. So it's unlikely that we're actually going to agree to everything Maliki is saying is necessary at this point.
No, well, he's probably doing a certain amount of posturing for a domestic audience. I mean, remember, the biggest remaining holdout to actual, comprehensive control of Iraq by the government is probably the Sadrist movement, al-Sadr's followers, and their very anti-American occupation. So he's probably striking
right.
a more defiant pose than we're going
to... The American press tends to play up what are, in fact, standard-issue posturing conflicts in Iraq as if, oh, my God, they're not going to reach a status of force agreement. Oh, my God, the government's going to collapse, when, in fact, the parties are just bargaining.
Well, yeah, so. Yeah. Or in this case, posturing for the public,
yeah.
Not necessarily bargaining. But, yeah, and maybe bargaining. Yeah, it could be a bargaining ploy, too. He asks for, asks for a dollar and he'll settle for 60 cents.
Anyway,
so you wanted to talk about McCain's advisory structure, the ever fascinating question of McCain's advisory structure.
The only reason it's important is that this week there's a whole kerfuffle over whether Mike Murphy would come back, and I think Jay Carney pointed out that
Mike Murphy, first of all, he's a well-known Republican.
He's a maverick
campaign strategist.
He's a maverick, not so conservative Republican consultant who's been quite successful in some campaigns, i.e., Arnold Schwarzenegger's campaign. He did Mitt Romney's campaign. He did one of Jeb Bush's campaigns.
He's a friend of yours.
He was McCain's advisor in 2000. He's a friend of mine. He lives out here. Doesn't mean I agree with everything he stands for, certainly, and doesn't mean I buy everything he says. But
so you're basically in the tank for him then.
I thought I just said I wasn't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Sorry, I'm bigger. Serotonin's flowing.
You're bigger than that.
I'm bigger than that. I'm bigger than
rise above my provocations.
I'm bigger than getting annoyed by your cheap provocations. Yes. Anyway, there was always McCain reshuffled his staff and did not include Murphy. Which is sort of what you'd expect, and then you would expect McCain to fail and fail and fail through the summer, and then at the end of the summer, McCain will panic and bring in Murphy. That might have happened, but Bill Kristol wrote this column saying, where's Murphy? Which, as Jay Carney said, sort of did Murphy in because it sort of raised his salience in a way. So now everybody's saying, well, Murphy is out. He signed a deal with NBC News to be a commentator. He's not going to come back. Why? First, I don't quite believe it. I think he can still come back. But second, why is this important? It's important because sort of the only...
Wait, can I ask you a prior question?
Yeah.
Why would Bill Kristol's pro-Murphy column have finished him off? I mean, it was plainly designed to help Murphy wind up in the campaign.
It was totally...
And in fact, the logic was, I mean, my reading of Kristol's logic is he associates Murphy with the theme of, quote, national greatness, which, of course, is code for neocon foreign policy. But in any event, whatever Kristol's motivation...
Well, that's one kiss of death right there, maybe.
Well, it was designed.
It was designed. They papered over this issue. Murphy was at least temporarily out. He was waiting in the wings. This said, okay, this is a big issue. It's being debated in the pages of the New York Times. We have to decide now: is he in or out? At the same time, Kristol sort of galvanizes the opposition to Murphy by slavishly praising Murphy, as if only he can save McCain. So all the other people who are saving McCain get pissed off. And they make McCain make a decision, and McCain decides Murphy's out.
So it
provokes a decision that otherwise wouldn't have been made, and he didn't provoke it in Murphy's favor.
So Kristol is an inept political operative, you're saying?
Well, duh. But also...
Is he famously inept? Is he famously inept?
He's been apt and inept. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But keep in mind, I mean, you know, he was a champion of comprehensive immigration reform. How did that work out?
Keep that serotonin up,
yeah,
and keep talking,
no,
Mickey.
No, I had
rise
a point
above,
about,
buddy.
I had a point about Kristol.
Pretend you didn't hear me laughing when you turned the conversation toward comprehensive immigration reform.
I had a point about Kristol.
Sorry, man.
Which you interrupted.
What can I do to get that serotonin up there? You're really great, Mickey.
Fuck. Anyway,
really
I almost
great.
Said something.
No, really.
Bob, wait.
Yeah. Sorry.
Kristol wrote that column because he needed a column. I mean, that's my point.
It was designed to help Murphy, and you're saying
it was designed to fill an empty space on the New York Times op-ed page. He had nothing else to write that day, so he wrote about Mike Murphy. And it had unintended political consequences.
That was a totally transparent attempt to help Murphy.
You assume Bill Kristol is some sort of genius who has this whole agenda plotted out. No, he has a deadline.
No, I'm asking you if he's a genius. What I'm asserting is that he's 100% political operative and not like a regular columnist.
Well, maybe he deluded himself into thinking, hey, I desperately need a column. Maybe I can use it to help bring back Murphy. Anyway, the reason Murphy is important is because the only way you can see McCain winning is to have some sort of battle of the personalities where people decide they really like McCain the way they liked Arnold Schwarzenegger, a campaign Murphy ran. And people think that Murphy is the guy who can do that. Right now, McCain is heading for disaster. He's trying not to offend people. He's sort of plottingly going through a conservative campaign. He obviously doesn't believe a word he says. He reads these speeches like he's in a hostage situation. He's heading for a loss. The only hope is to get him out there calling people drunks, making jokes about cigarettes killing the Iranians, and have people say, hey, this guy's so un-PC that, like Jesse Ventura and Arnold Schwarzenegger, we want to be with him for 4 years. And when you get rid of Murphy, you're getting rid of that strategy and adopting the plotting loser strategy. That's why it's important. Maybe Murphy couldn't pull it off. Maybe he could. Rich Lowry has a very good post on National Review saying, McCain isn't that funny. Once you've heard one drunk joke, he stops being entertaining. That could be, in which case he's even more doomed than we thought. But it does seem to me that's why it is of significance that if Murphy really is out, which I don't believe.
So wait, to some extent it's a choice as to whether we turn McCain into this likable, attractive person? Create that image of him, not that he's not already thought that way in a lot of quarters, but
he had that image in 2000.
Right, so it's either revive that image versus the kind of policy-by-policy positioning?
Yes.
Okay. I do think that sometimes the entire pundit class overestimates the importance of position, of issue-by-issue positioning by candidates.
Totally.
And underestimates just the sheer impression they're making. And I think that's the miscalculation Obama's been making in readjusting himself policy by policy and in the process totally recasting the image of him that people had.
Well, I think he recast it in a good way, but he's replaced this oh my God, he's a closet hardcore lefty image with we don't know what the hell he is image, this sort of image of fuzziness that's been unfortunate.
Well, I mean, you're starting off with your perception, oh, he's a closet lefty. I was thinking about the perception of people other than you, like, oh, he's this interesting guy who is above politics and could help unify the country and so on.
Well, he could still be that and still be fuzzy. I mean, I don't think he's killed that. He's lost.
The idea, he had this image as a transcendent figure. I don't mean I was, like, you know, naively buying it in all its dimensions. I'm saying he had cultivated that image successfully among a lot of people.
I guess. I mean, it seems to me people also thought he was a crusader for truth and justice against the Iraq war and for national health care, et cetera, et cetera. And he's fuzzed up that a little of the Iraq war, at least. So that has a specific left ideological component, whereas you gave, you know, there's also this anodyne, I'm above politics. I agree that the overall character logical impression is much more important than the specific policies, and that he's lost some of that. I agree with that. It relates to this Kinsley article on Al Franken, where he talks about how so much of our professional political class is designed to avoid taking umbrage, or giving umbrage, and saying anything that might offend anybody. And Al Franken is a guy who's most of his life has been saying things to offend everybody. Now he's trying to enter politics, and this is an interesting test case of whether you could do that. But Schwarzenegger and Jesse Ventura were also that test case, and McCain could also be a character who fights this in a way that Obama doesn't, fights the, transcends conventional PC politics by being completely on PC and offending everybody and say, so what, I'm a human being.
McCain
would be the pro Kinsley candidate here, who would violate all these sterile norms of politics.
Not that Mike would support him, but that's consistent with the theme of this column Mike wrote, which was a very good column.
Mike has fallen for him in the past, but go ahead.
I'm sure Mike would support Obama over McCain.
No, that's true. I'm just saying Mike has liked McCain personally.
Yeah. All journalists have fallen for his act. I mean, have liked him.
Yeah, but go ahead. You were saying something. Sorry.
One thing I liked in this in Mike's column was this idea of the culture of umbrage, which is, I mean, I'm not sure if this is exactly what he had in mind, but it does seem like a huge amount of this campaign. Well, he even has the line. There's a sentence in here. He writes, despite the Iraq war, despite the sinking economy, despite the price of gasoline, we have frittered away our politics in a round robin of gaffes, mock indignation, demands for apology, and more gaffes. And it's true, and one feature of it is it's not just the politicians themselves. It's not just Obama and McCain saying things that are taken as offensive. It's like the deal seems to be if anyone even remotely connected to them says anything that offends anyone, there's this uproar about how they have to disavow the person, and I think that's a little new. At least the extent of it is new, and I think the reasons up for it are kind of obvious. You know, more and more of what everyone says is documented, is on the record, so the chances are pretty slim that none of your advisors have said anything on the record that's offensive, and so on. I hope the political process will kind of adjust to it so that our threshold for offense will get
people,
a little higher.
I mean, God, if I ever run for office and I have to answer for the things that you've said, like that dingaling last week about the tendency of dogs to lick their private parts, I'm in deep trouble. I mean, Al Franken's got nothing on blogging heads as far as embarrassing, you know, video clips.
I have no idea what you're talking about, and I deny having made any reference.
It's on tape, buddy.
To dogs' genitals, and I certainly meant no offense to dogs, who I think have been really the bedrock of this great nation of ours.
Well said. The real umbrage war was between Hillary and Obama, though, not so much. I mean, there's a little bit of that between McCain and Obama. I mean, McCain saying that, oh, Obama's going on the attack, when really he's just attacked McCain's energy plan because it doesn't provide for any energy immediately. I mean, if that's an attack ad, McCain's, you know, got something coming to him. But Hillary and Obama was a constant umbrage war.
But it's also, you know, again, disavowing, you know, Obama has to disavow, you know, Wes Clark, Samantha Power, you know, what's his name, Malley, the Middle East advisor. You know, it's
you're forgetting Reverend Flieger.
Yeah, well, that's the only one McCain's done. He still hasn't denounced Reverend Parsley. Now let me switch to favoring these denunciations. It's interesting that McCain denounced the guy who offended Catholics, but refuses to denounce the guy that I think he's equally close to, who calls Islam an evil religion. So I guess the rule is, you know, you cannot moderately offend Catholics, but you're allowed to say anything about Muslims, I guess is the rule in the McCain camp.
You're talking about Reverend Hagee, not Reverend Flieger.
No, I didn't say Flieger. I thought I said Parsley.
Okay.
Hagee offended Catholics. McCain disavowed him.
But I
Parsley
said
Islam is an evil religion, and I don't think I could stand to be corrected, but I don't think McCain has disavowed him. But I digress.
Well, I disavow you, and I denounce you.
I accept that stoically because my serotonin level is not as low as yours, Mickey. I'm brushing the dirt off my shoulders here.
You're employing powerful pop culture memes. There's no way I can resist that.
That was a dog whistle to the hip hop part of our audience.
It's like
of our demo.
Anyway, don't get me started on hip hop.
Okay.
Obama praised.
But another time. Let's talk about it next time. It's a good topic. Send me something to read about it, and we'll argue. I'll defend it
Obama sort of gives this lecture to high school students where he says he praises Lil Wayne, and Lil Wayne's big hit now has this, like a verse where he's having sex with Hillary Clinton. It's like, it's not clear that Obama, it seems to me Obama should be more skeptical of the amount of filth and degeneracy in hip-hop culture as opposed to pretending he's hip and embracing it while giving stern lectures, Bill Cosby-esque lectures to high school students. At least Bill Cosby is sort of frankly adversarial and sort of a pissed off old man. There's a certain gritty integrity in that.
I am not a big fan of the overall moral tone that seems to me to emanate from a lot of hip hop. Let me say that. Yeah. While admitting that I have almost no familiarity with the actual content of it. But
anyway, we could talk
we should have that discussion, but next time we should have the hip hop discussion. Let's save it.
Okay, we'll both make fools of ourselves, but that's what we're here for.
Not the kind of fools we'd make if we tried to talk about it right now before I've read anything about it.
Good point. Well, John McWhorter has a book on hip hop, so we should.
I know, new book. He's discussed it on Blogging.
So we should review that material first. Then we will.
Yeah, I've listened to his dialogue about it, so I'll be well versed. I should move to comments unless you have further.
No, go ahead.
Comments, okay.
Comments are your people, all 12 of them.
I'm going to get to that, Mickey. One of our commenters says, my goal, quote, to achieve alpha commenter status, which I believe comes from being mentioned in Bob and Mickey's viewer comments section. That's what this commenter says. And if I mentioned his or her name, he would have achieved his or her goal. He or she would have.
But you did.
I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that because you do not reach alpha status that easily. Sorry, bud.
You're cruelly toying with him.
Yes.
I think you have serotonin poisoning.
No, I just want to encourage a little more substantive input to our comments section. Now, you'll be happy about this. The commenter known as BRUCDS, and this is an example of the civilizing effect of our comments section, which I will return to later. BRUCDS made this post about our last dialog. Christ Kaus is a, and then there's a slang reference to a male genital, Mickey. And then he says, I can't listen to this one, meaning this dialogue. Now, if you came back some minutes after this was posted, you would see that it had been deleted by the very guy who left it. And he posts, and, you know, there's a place you can fill out your reason for deletion, and he says about his saying, Christ couches a male genital, he says this, a trivial truth hastily and rudely blurted out. So there, Mickey, he kind of takes it back.
I don't think he took it back. That's supposed to build my serotonin level, Bob? Thank you for mentioning that.
Well, anyway, he did delete it.
I'm deeply gratified.
No, but, you know, okay, well, let me move on to what a hostage I am to my my base of commenters, as you alleged last time.
You're building this whole self-reinforcing cocoon by citing commenters who agree with you.
No, I have done shout-outs. That reminds me. Pacivorous, one of our many cherished, or too few, but cherished conservative commenters. I comprehend in only a vague way that he deserves some kind of get-well card. He suffered some foot injury that sounds like it might actually be quite severe many months ago, and he's been recuperating from it. This is what,
man,
I infer from the comment section.
Man, even the little sparrow does not escape your notice. You worry about world apocalypse on the one hand and Pacivorous's foot injury on the other.
No, I do. I mean, it sounded like it's been like a career-changing event for him, I think.
Okay.
It sounds like, if I understand the thing correctly, he was a handyman, and he's not going to be able to pursue that craft anymore.
Oh, okay, that sucks.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
So it's serious. And I meant to say that last week, actually. I meant to say, you know, get well or whatever you say. So from B.J. Keefe, this gets to the subject of how I'm a slave to my base, as you claim. He, after, you know, totally trashing me for kind of seeming to trash Obama for all the alleged flip-flopping, or at least, you know, pivoting last week, after doing that, the next day on another dialogue wrote, Bob, I guess I owe you a little bit of an apology for my comments, because he had just seen much the same case made by a different blogging head, and this apparently was more persuasive, and he kind of saw how there was some merit to my position. But what's interesting is that when I saw that he had apologized, I had that feeling, you know, I mean, I knew he was mad at me, and you know that feeling you have with people, you know, where, like, you think you've offended them, and you think they're mad at you, and then you see them, and they're fine with you, and you know, there's a sense of relief?
I know that feeling.
Is it scary that I had that feeling with a commenter?
It is. Why was he mad at you?
Because I had kind of trashed Obama.
On the Jerusalem point?
No. On pivoting in general, including that. You and I had spent a lot of time on the pivoting. He thought I should have criticized
McCain
more.
Yeah, that's sort of pathetic. Shouldn't you? I mean, here Wally says you should live in a virtual world where you treat your virtual friends better than your real friends, and here you are worrying about a virtual friend, this guy you've never met, who you probably wouldn't agree with on more than 30% of the issues, and you're worried about offending him, and what about your wife and children? You should be worrying about them, buddy.
Wow, that was an amazing connection you made to the early part of the dialogue, and it imparts such symmetry to this that I'm tempted to just end the thing now, but I don't want to. I have a couple more things.
Okay, I'll just take a nap.
But I should say, I mean, B.J. Keefe is a particularly benign influence in the comments section.
Okay.
It's not like just any old commenter could make me feel guilty. Although a number could.
I'll be the judge of that. But anyway, I'll just take a nap while you talk about the commenters.
Well, no, wait. We're coming to you, Mickey.
Okay.
So you made this critique here, I'll let Uncle Ebenezer say it. So Mickey whines that the comment board is dominated by 12 liberal commenters, hereafter referred to as the Gang of 12. Well, first, it seems a strange complaint from a self-defined Democrat. He makes a good point, Mickey. Why are you complaining about liberal commenters if, as you claim, you're actually a liberal?
Well, I'm not that kind of liberal. You know, neoliberal. We hate liberals.
So he says, Mickey no doubt has plenty of fellow liberal haters who read his Slate column, so why don't they all come here and argue with the domineering liberal elites? Mickey must not be trying very hard to bring them over here. I will say, actually, you've linked to our site very generously, but it's true, if we look at your most recent link, that you don't seem to be bringing them here to ponder substantive differences of opinion between you and me weigh in on them.
First,
because that last link consisted only of me saying, let's face it,
say it again,
dogs
lick again. That's
are
right.
Inclined to lick their penises, right? And And it just seems to me that, that bringing people to highlighting that particular segment is not the way you foment robust and illuminating debate on the great issues of our time.
First, I don't care whether people come and comment. I have no desire to bring them here to comment. I think that'd be wasting their time. Second, you're the one who's...
You think they're wasting their time?
You're the one who's fixated on commenters. Yes, because, I don't know. Anyway.
I'm going to make a serious argument that you're wrong in a second, but go ahead.
It's incredibly disingenuous because you're constantly begging me for links that'll give you hits. So I give you these cheap links that say not safe for work that bring you hits and let you go to your investors and say, oh, gee, we have a lot of hits. And then you attack me for doing that on blogging heads. You're a two-faced hypocrite.
Jeez. I wouldn't say two-faced, no, but...
you like that link. You sent me an email saying thanks for the link. Now you're attacking me for it.
I send those emails to everybody who link. I mean, sorry, not that you're not special, but you know, as a blogger, you send emails that say thanks for the link, don't you?
Sometimes, but...
Yeah, sometimes. That's standard internet procedure,
buddy.
Don't
expect it to happen again.
Well, I won't.
Take my blog.
And I take it back. I love, Mickey, I meant to tell you, I loved that dog penis.
I'm going
to
take my blog and go home.
Okay, but now you'll be happy to know Ann Althaus is on your side. She embedded the part where your major silly little critique of our commenters, which it turns out, you know, it was based on a comment on our section from somebody named R.C. Ocean, I guess, or something like that. And he or she is an Althaus commenter.
Uh-huh.
And so she says, she embeds that segment and says, R.C., aren't you pleased to know that Kaus has your words posted on his monitor for inspiration?
They're right here. Here they are.
Right. And R.C. says, LOL, Mickey's a funny guy. That's why I watch him. Well, that and the inside Hollywood gossip, which we actually haven't gotten in a while. But anyway, Althaus's commenter Verso points out that, well, you might use the phrase trivial truth, as we used earlier, that it's actually a well-known fact that all comment sections, you know, if you see like 100 comments, it turns out there's only 20 people doing them. That's just the dynamics of comment sections. And so it's like not an especially pioneering observation on your part.
But I had veered away from reality, so it was a dose of cold water that brought me back to the reality that you're spending a large part of your life whoring after the affections of 12 people. And how pathetic is that?
Compared to what? I mean, whose affections are you whoring after? How many people right now? Now, also, they're probably all, you know, women, and some of them are married, and you shouldn't be even thinking about their affections. But go ahead. How many people?
No, you're probably...
How many people are you whoring after the affection of right now, Mickey?
Probably 12, but they're not...
Okay.
But they're not... They were selected by me, not self-selected people who happened to nominate themselves to comment on my website. Big difference.
I don't know. I actually think real physical life is just like the internet. You go out and you do this presentation of self. You send out these vibes. People who respond to them, you know, they become your sphere of influence.
I thought your whole theory was based on the fact that the web has changed reality so that we actually have different social interactions and more terrorism and all sorts of bad things happen. And one of the bad things is you pay attention to your commenters.
Oh... If you had commenters, Mickey, which you'll have if you ever have a real blog, you would pay attention to them, too. No, I'm sorry. I take back that part about a real blog.
I actually have commenters, but they're in the fray.
They're buried in the fray, and you never look at them, and they know it.
All this is true.
Now, just in closing, Ann Althaus endorsed your critique of our commenters in this item of hers that I should remember to link to. I just want to say, okay... The first of all, the basic dynamic that, you know, X number of commenters winds up being responsible for X times 5 number of comments is probably true of her blog and many others. But as long as Anne is going to critique our comments section, I would make this defense of it. And I would challenge Anne to reply to this defense of it. I maintain, I mean, if you look at Anne's comment section, it's like the comment section of blogs in general, which is that there's kind of a preaching to the choir dynamic there, right? It's a natural thing that if you have one person who's always the person whose voice you hear in the blog, you develop basically a fan club in your comment section. It's not to say there's never disagreement in her comment section or others, but basically in most blogs, it's pretty damn homogeneous. Now, Mickey, you may think ours is really homogeneous, but the fact is, if you look at our comment section, I would like to know if anybody can find another comment section anywhere in the internet, may be there, I'm just not aware of it, where you have as vigorous a debate covering as wide a part of the ideological spectrum conducted in as usually civil terms as you often get on, in our comment section.
Our comment section used to be much better than it is now. Now it's dominated by these lefties. It used to be much more Catholic. I claim if I had a blog, I would not have a fan club. And
there's a separate explanation for that, buddy, but go ahead.
There are plenty of blogs that have much better comment section. Bizarrely, the best comment section I've seen is on this blog by this guy, Bill Bradley, who writes New West Notes, and he writes about California politics, and it has an incredibly high level of discussion. I mean, he gets the campaign.
Well, he's not very partisan, right?
Well, he's not wildly partisan, but he has strong views. He likes Schwarzenegger. He likes Warren Beatty. He likes the people he likes. He actually likes McCain, too. But he's a smart guy, and he gets in there and mixes it up, and he gets people like prominent consultants come and comment on his blog, and they have a very, very high level of discussion. I don't even like what he says often that much, but the commenters are by far and away the best I've ever seen.
Well, the other approach to getting that kind of comment section would be to do a heavily repertorial and not very ideological blog, or heavily analytical / repertorial or whatever. Anyway, I do issue this friendly challenge to Anne. Show me the comment section that has as much, I think, actual disagreement. I mean, it's true that on the center of gravity here is left of center in the comment section. I'd be happy for it to move to the right. And if you ever sent your viewers here to see anything other than utterances about dog genitals,
I do.
I
do substantive links all the time, and then you beg me for the cheap links that are not safe for work.
Right. I did. I remember sending you that email asking for a dog penis link.
But in other cases, you sent me cheapo links that were not substantive. I usually do the substantive links, and they don't send you enough people to satisfy your insatiable craving for hits.
Okay. Well, if I start suggesting some highly substantive links, will you?
We're through. I'm out of the linking business. This is the thanks I get.
Oh man.
Mandy, you know.
And does this mean I've also failed to raise
totally.
Your serotonin level the way you're responding to this,
totally,
Mickey?
Totally.
Wow.
I think
maybe I moved it in the direction I wasn't intending to move it.
I'm in the bitter slough of the spawn now. I'm just lashing out.
You really are, man. It started off with Josh Marshall, and now it's me. It's kind of...
I know. It's grim.
It's bad. Should we end on this note, or do you think you can stage a recovery, or what?
I have a final bit of banter, which is, you know what the number one pop song in America is? It's a song called I Kissed the Girl.
Well, that's by, that's number one again?
I think it's number one right now, and it's a different version than the version by the far superior song by Jill Soviel.
Oh. Okay.
But it's the same basic theme, so we can stick in another plug for your friend Jill Sobule, who has a much better version, better song of the same theme and title.
Let's plug her Mexican wrestler song, which is really a superb song. We'll try to link to that video again.
Well, okay.
That's a superb song.
She's a good artist. She has more than one song. Jesus.
She's great.
You're insulting her. You're insulting her by constantly harping on the same song.
Mickey, don't extend your low serotonin to her, okay? I don't think that's the way she would react to what I just said.
I mentioned Mexican wrestler, and I told you what her reaction was. So. She did not say, oh, great, thank you. She said, Mexican wrestler,
If we got her here on Blogging Heads, do you think that would, and to talk to you, would that, do you think that would raise your serotonin level?
Probably, yes, but she'd be too sunny in general.
But that might be good.
What?
I think you could use a little sun, buddy.
On the radio, they can't see you smile. So I've been smiling throughout.
Okay, Mickey, I'm sorry about all the hurtful things I said.
Bob, it doesn't...
Really?
It doesn't bother me.
Okay, good, because I'm really actually not all that sorry, just a little.
I figured.
Okay.
Okay, this is like an endless one, so let's end it.
Let's end it now, okay.
See you next week.
Okay.